We argue about guns all the time in America, but seldom question our ownership of another dangerous piece of metal, the family car. That appliance can and does cause plenty of misery, and we do get training in how to drive. But really, when was the last time you changed anything about your driving process or technique, or even questioned it? We'll get a brush up today from Ben Collins, the author of How to Drive, Real World Instruction and Advice from Hollywood's Top Driver. Ben Collins raced cars in NASCAR and Formula One, spent years as the Stig on the BBC show Top Gear, and was the driver stand-in for actors in many a movie chase scene, including the Batman film The Dark Knight Rises and three different James Bond films. A lot on his resume. Ben Collins, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. I figured you had to start with a disclaimer. There is a short section in the front called How Not to Drive. It sounds like you learned the hard way.
I did, yeah. I was pretty stubborn, a stubborn learner. I had a very natural feel for a car and what its limits were, and then routinely broke those limits because my attitude hadn't really caught up. So I was successful on the racetrack and then a bit of a loser on the road, and kept driving into big, heavy things that smashed my car up. So I thought that would be a good example. And really, rather than have other people learning by mistakes, I hope that people could learn from mine as well as learning the good stuff.
What makes it a good example is that you probably could have pulled the maneuver between the truck and the hedge and the road off if it hadn't been for the fact that there was something you didn't plan for, which was mud. And that's really the issue, is being prepared for anything, isn't it?
That's it. There's a whole raft of things that we learn on the job as drivers. And really, you know, the majority of people in the world, and certainly the States, we learn the amount of flying time we get before we pass the test is around 18 hours. And when you put that in context, a Starbucks barista gets 24 hours of training to handle an espresso machine. So I think a car deserves a little bit more attention, a bit more thinking. And it's just trying to open people's eyes to the wider experience, because we get thrown out there. And we have to learn by doing, and learning about different surfaces, different weather conditions, and how they affect grip at the tire. The tire really is the only thing that matters, and if it doesn't bite the tarmac, you end up skidding, and suddenly you're into a whole new world.
You really do get quite a bit into tires here, and in fact, you talk about you and the tire really are the biggest relationship.
That's absolutely true. Every sensation any driver will feel is as a result of the tire. And you could have a Ferrari, but if you put terrible, cheap rubber on the thing, it's going to feel pretty ham. So the best thing you can invest in is the tire. And particularly if you get challenging conditions in the winter when it's, there's snow and ice around, winter tires have been a really great choice. Actually, there's new technology now that means you don't have to do an IndyCar or NASCAR style pit stop and change your wheels once or twice a year. You can actually get genuine sort of multi-climate tires now that cope just as well in the winter as the summer. So that's a great breakthrough, and it saves a lot of pain. But unless that tire is in contact with the surface, you're skidding, and you end up looking like you are in a James Bond film for the wrong reason.
Right. Now, it's not just the substance of the tires themselves. You also cite a tire backside connection in the book. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, we all have that bond. For some reason, human beings are innately capable of handling speeds that are way in excess of what our bodies were designed to do. So that's pretty cool. And one of the things that in our evolution is, survival. And I think tuning into that instinct is really crucial for the road. So we have that natural feel. We can, same as stepping out of a bathtub, you can feel underfoot if the floor is slippery and wet. And it's that same connection, that same sense of balance that we have and we feel in the car, but routinely don't pay attention to it because there's so many other things we're thinking about or distractions with the mobile phone. But really what we should be in tune with is that jungle instinct that's the stuff that saves you from being eaten by a bear and it should keep you focused on the job of driving. And actually, you the more you get into it, the more you enjoy it. And that's what I'm all about.
In the introduction to How to Drive, you say that speed alone is often not the issue for accidents. What do you suppose is?
It's very easy to say, oh, it's speed kills, and it's not. It's the sudden stop that kills you, not just traveling quickly. Many of the fastest cars in the world have the best brakes, enabling them to stop and slow down much, much quicker. So the biggest failing as drivers is failing to pay attention and just simple errors. The safest roads we have are the fastest roads, the interstates, the freeways, the fewest number of people are killed there. It's in cities you're more likely to hurt a pedestrian, and it's the rural roads where as drivers, we come unstuck and we can really hurt ourselves. And that's the biggest area for Americans on a day-to-day basis, is that you know, that journey across country. Not everybody has that, takes that route, obviously, but that's where your skills as a driver are tested, and that's when it pays to understand how best to take a curve and stay safe.
Let's talk a little bit about your history, Ben. How does somebody get to drive for a living?
Well, I started early by crashing a John Deere lawnmower aged 4 years old. That was one of my early lessons. I was able to get on the thing and make it go, but my feet couldn't reach the brake pedal, so that was a quick lesson. I've always been obsessed by cars, anything with wheels and an engine, and I was very fortunate to get a chance to jump in a racing car when I was 18 years old, and the love affair has continued since that day. I went through the single-seater route to try and to compete in Formula One, and then switched across into Le Mans, 24-hour racing, GT, and also NASCAR. So I got I won the European version of NASCAR, and then came across to the US for a try at that too. So I've been very fortunate. And then the filming side of things really came through Top Gear, which is a British TV show about cars. So it's perfect for me, and I played the role of an anonymous guy, a little bit like Darth Vader, but in a white suit, not black.
Okay, so that was the Stig.
That was the Stig, yeah.
Uh-huh. It sounds like it was a lot of fun.
It was great. I mean, that character, despite being on TV, no one ever knew the name of the person playing the role, so there'd be a question mark when the credits rolled. And for me, that was fantastic because the media were going crazy. It was at one point in the top 10 searches on Google, who is the Stig? And I felt very privileged. I was just in front of What Is the Meaning of Life? Just behind Am I Pregnant? So I felt that I'd achieved something by this. But all good things come to an end. And it was actually during my time on TV in that role that YouTube really developed. Wikipedia wouldn't leave me alone. And eventually the secret was revealed.
All right. Ben Collins is, or was, the Stig, is now the author of a book called How to Drive, Real World Instruction and Advice from Hollywood's Top Driver. We'll come back and get some real world ideas about what to do with ourselves behind the wheel of a car and above the pedals from Ben when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the British race and stunt car driver Ben Collins, who is telling us how to do what he does. No, actually, he's telling us how to do what we do better, because all those years he learned dealing with the physics of cars and the things they do and don't do, he's put into a book for us called How to Drive, Real World Instruction and Advice from Hollywood's Top Driver. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. You may have many questions about things you've been doing over the years and whether they're the right things to do. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We just got a little bit of your history, Ben. Let's talk about the history of driving. Now, you're British, but you do think that driving on the left is better, generally. Why?
Well, the Romans thought so, and there could be a number of reasons for that, but The widely accepted view is that most humans are right-hand dominant, right-eye dominant, and for passing other traffic, that's the best side to be on, because you've got the best opportunity to see what's coming. So, the Romans drove on the left, and then most of the world did as well. But, the early pioneers in America drove, I think, initially on both sides, and because they relied heavily on transports that were of French design, the concertina wagon, they ended up switching sides, and that's kind of where set the foundations for many other countries, because obviously with the fantastic car manufacturing plants of Detroit and other places, mass production, Henry Ford, all that good stuff, everybody around the world wanted to buy American cars, and soon enough most of the world was driving on the right-hand side. So that's the story. But as to which is better, who knows? It's a tough one.
But there's a visual thing, you think, a visual advantage, you think, the driving on the left?
It is. I mean, for people like me with that side, you can, with your stronger eye, you can see further down the road when you're coming to make a pass. So there's a little bit of an advantage with that. And cyclists tend to dismount on the left-hand side, which in Europe is easier for them. But I think really it's more making fun of each other, because there really isn't a huge difference whether you drive on the left or the right, as long as you do the right thing in the right country.
All right. There's a whole aside on America and cars. And is there any country in your experience that comes as close to our love affair? I mean, that even rivals us for our great affection for cars?
I think possibly the Italians. They're way up there. I love the way they drive. They've got this fantastic mix. So they're in a hurry. They use the horn a lot. They're on that. They use that sort of, I don't know, the way we breathe. But without getting angry, that's the beautiful thing. People don't seem to get road rage. They do some fist shaking, but they don't really mean it. So I think Italians love cars. They make great cars, you know, obviously Ferrari. But actually, for really deep dug into the roots, I think, you know, driving is so much part of the American adventure, because those great distances between towns, between states, and covering them, really, the car is that transport to freedom, and it's just such an integral part of American life.
It's not terribly surprising to learn from your book that we kind of got out ahead of ourselves just a little bit. I mean, we got the machines and we did things with them, but then we started thinking about things like safe driving a while later. I mean, so how long after we had cars did we start coming up with things like driver's licenses and driving instruction?
Yeah, it's a fun story. And I mean, the first road fatality that was known, the first person killed by a car, I think it took place at 7 miles an hour. Which doesn't sound very, you know, doesn't sound like an action movie in the making, but it happened very quickly. But nevertheless, we're safer in cars than we were on horses. They were killing quite a few people back in the day, in smaller numbers. So it's really part of human evolution. Wherever there's a thing called risk homeostasis as well, which is basically we adjust our risk profile. If we feel too comfortable, then we go a bit faster, we start multitasking, we start playing with phones. The paradox is that these cars that keep saying they're safer, they have ABS brakes, they have airbags, people are more inclined just to sort of switch off from driving and stare at the phone. But for now, at least, and for the next 10 years, until a car really can drive itself, and they definitely cannot do that properly at the moment, the human is the most important part. The smartest thing in the car is our brains.
Well, since you went there, let's take this up. I mean, I have to believe that somebody like you probably is totally opposed to the idea of driverless cars, but how do you feel about them?
I think I can see it as a solution in city centres, but I'm pretty much, you guessed it, I'm against it. I think the temptation will be for these things to be running around everywhere, and I can imagine it adding to congestion, not reducing it, because, you know, if the thing drives itself, then just take me to the store, and if there's no parking, drive around for half an hour. And you can imagine this thing, and I also can, you know, again, human nature, what are people going to do in these cars when they get bored? And you know, I just think of that. And for me, I love driving, so why on earth would I want to sit there with a robot trying to do it? And when it comes to, again, what we were talking about before, the challenging conditions, mud, snow, ice, all that fun stuff, really, they think that these sensors won't go wrong? I'm not so sure. Having been sent to the wrong side of town several times by the GPS, I don't trust the systems as far as I can throw them.
Well, that's true. If the maps can send us to the wrong places, why wouldn't the cars?
Yeah.
Yeah, same company. You do write of the prep for driving tests, Ben, as the creaking gospel of the DMV handbook. That sounds like a rather arch criticism.
Well, I don't mean to be too critical. I'm only poking fun, and a lot of hard work has gone into those manuals, and there's a lot of great material in them, for sure. What's hard is for those manuals to stay current, because literally just the way that cars propel themselves these days, they're becoming electric again. They were in the 1890s. The first cars in Paris were all run by electric, so it's not a new thing, but it's come back, and the Tesla is really leading the way with that. They drive in a completely different way to cars from yesteryear. And so you've got diesel, you've got hybrid, all these different systems. And it's hard for the DMV manual to stay up to speed with that. Braking distances alone in the DMV guides from state to state vary hugely, where actually these are laws of physics and really dictated by the tire and the conditions. So I jest with the DMV manual. It's a great starting point, but we need something that's more current, and hopefully that's what I'm trying to achieve with this book. And each year I'll be adding to it and keeping people up to speed with what's happening.
If you got to be the international emperor of driving, would you have us start later? Would you have us get more training, a combination thereof?
Emperor, that'd be great. What a great title. yeah, that sounds good. I think as long as we... I don't. starting later, I don't think is helpful. And there's different studies that show that, you know, the earlier you start, really, and let's face it, your children are learning from the way you drive in the back seat from the day they're born. They watch. If you get road rage, if you are rough with the steering, if you stamp on the brakes like you're putting out a fire, your kids watch this, and lo and behold, they'll drive like you. So they learn from a young age anyway, and I think the sooner they learn the right way to drive, the better. And, you know, I hope for the future that certainly with virtual reality technology and the pace of change with driving games, which they're called games still, but really they simulate real life now so closely, that that's a fantastic opportunity for educating kids in a way that they are much more naturally inclined to learn from.
Ben Collins is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He drove as the Stig on Top Gear on the BBC for several years. He was also in The Dark Knight Rises as a driver of the Batmobile, drove in three different James Bond films, raced for NASCAR and Formula One. He's been all over the world with steering wheels in his hands. He's put out a book for us called How to Drive, Real World Instruction and Advice from Hollywood's Top Driver. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Maybe some questions about technique, maybe some stories of your own about driving situations you wish you'd handled differently or did handle well. 800-838-3760 is our phone number. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Ben, Jeannie in Medford dropped off a question about, she says she met Graham Hill. That's really important for her to get that in there. Also wants to know what you think about Can-Am racing, which is no longer a thing.
Well, Can-Am was an incredible era. I raced a car that was kind of similar. It was an 800 horsepower monster that looked like a door wedge in the same way as Can-Am. They had those beautiful flowing lines and just hyper amounts of horsepower. So the guys that raced those were pretty brave. We're lucky we still have Grand-Am now, so that's a great series in the US and the Le Mans series and the FIA World Sports Car Series. So yeah, there are things that have kind of superseded it, but Can-Am will always have a special place, I think.
Wow, 800 horsepower, you said?
Yeah, that's it, and normally aspirated, no turbocharging, whereas I think a lot of the Can-Ams had a little bit of help.
Wow.
But not so much grip as I had, so they were brave boys. Wheel spin in every gear.
By comparison, the little locomotives that work in switch yards are 600 horsepower.
There you go. Well, I look forward to getting in one.
Louise in Ashland wants to know if you can talk about cars not needing to warm up and don't need to idle more than a minute or so to reduce emissions.
Okay, so this is the new tech that's allowing them to get up to speed a little better. Yeah, the emissions side of life, it's incredible how much that's advanced, and obviously with the different power systems, with electric, there's no warming up at all if you just drive off. With the range that's extending all the time on that side, that's great. But all manufacturers vary, so I would say on that one, it's best to check, as boring as it sounds as an answer, check the manual and see what yours does.
Okay. Let's come back to the contents of the book and talk about driving position. You know, you got issues here, front, back, up, down. What's the best place to be in? And low for sure is what you say, but how close to the pedals?
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to think. Ultimately, you need to be able to control the car properly, and that means if you're very short, you need to bring the seat forward so that your legs aren't too straight. And one of the silly causes of accidents is people sit too far back, too far away from the wheel and the pedals, and when they really have to press the brake pedal to avoid an accident and steer around, their foot can't put enough pressure, so they don't slow down quickly enough, and it's a silly way to have a crash that you could otherwise avoid. So you want about 30 degrees bend at the elbow, similar at the knee, so that you're comfortable, and then you can reach everything. So, not too close is bad, but too far away is worse. And really, it's just a case of finding somewhere that's comfortable. And that's the other thing. The more comfortable you are, the less tiresome a long journey is, so you're more likely to stay awake.
Okay, so no straight arms, no straight legs, it sounds like. You want some bend in knees and elbows.
That's it.
Okay, now what about the incline of the seat back? I mean, I've seen a fair number of people look like they want to drive almost lying down.
Well, good luck to them if they hit anything. That doesn't work for me. I guess if you never leave the city limits and you don't go faster than 20 miles an hour and you don't really care, and it's all about what you look like, then power to you. It's not in my playbook.
All right. So now the transfer of weight, you say, is the key to driving. So how? What are some of the things we need to think about in terms of smoothing that transfer of weight out?
Yeah, but the smooth driving is what racing drivers use on the track to keep the car stable, and therefore they can load the front or rear tires at the right time in the corner. So braking before the curve puts the weight onto the front tires, and they do the biggest amount of stopping the car. That's what really pulls the speed off the thing. As you get off the brake pedal, the platform goes stable, the weight settles across all four tires, and that's when you've got maximum grip across the whole platform for turning through the curve. And then it's only when the corner and the curve opens out, that's when you start to accelerate. The car sits back onto the back tires. Most American vehicles are rear-wheel drive. Well, that's maybe not quite true, probably 50-50. So it puts the weight where you need it to get that drive and that support. If you jiggle the car around and you're forever jumping on and off the pedals, the tires don't really know where they are. They can never produce their optimal grip. So that's really why the smooth driving approach works on the track and on the road. And by not braking needlessly all the time, by looking further ahead to anticipate traffic flow, you can save 20% on your gas bill, which is decent. I know that oil price is good for us drivers at the moment, but even still, money saved is money earned, and it's an easy way to do it.
So, Ben, when you drive, can you really sense each of the four tires individually?
Well, in a way, you can. You feel it collectively, and you feel it through, obviously, the suspension is there. That's supporting you in the curve, and you feel that feedback. But ultimately, your brain is absorbing that balancing act, and it's kind of like walking on a high wire. You're not thinking about maybe every individual toe, but you can feel the weight shift from your heel to your toe as the weight shifts forward and backwards and side to side. So it's very much that same sort of feeling. And the more you practice that, the more in tune you feel, which is why I love the days of the old school hydraulic power steering, where you could really feel in your fingertips what's happening as the tires meet the road at the front axle, which is harder to do these days with electric power steering.
But not fond of the one finger allowing you to make all the turns?
That's not so good for me, no. But these systems, they are developing them, and not everybody has gone that route. Ford are doing a great job with their cars. They've kept it real. And many other manufacturers in the U.S. as well. So, there's hopefully a little revolution and technical development that will keep humans in tune with what's happening.
Ben Collins is our guest on The Exchange. His book is How to Drive. Here's a call from Jill in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, yes. We're wondering, could you tell us what the initials stand for the MGTC?
In what? In English cars or something?
In English cars, yes.
All right. MGTC. Does that ring a bell, Ben?
Is this the MG car, the British sports car?
Is that what we're talking about, the MG brand, Jill?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay.
Well, I'm wishing I had Google at my fingertips, and I could tell you what it all stands for, but they don't. All I know is they don't make them anymore, but it was a classic British sports car, so usually found in green and quite fun to drive, particularly in good weather, which we don't get much in Britain, so the roof rarely came off. But obviously you're a fan of the MG brand.
Mm-hmm, indeed. Thanks for that, Jill. Debbie in Talent writes, I hope there's a chapter in the book about backing out of parking places and parking lots. It is my theory that parking lots are the most dangerous places to drive or walk, and I'm surprised that millions don't die every day at the mall.
That's a good observation. I guess it depends. I mean, the good thing is that the speeds in car parks are fairly low, despite what you see in the movies, and that's one of the things. And that's where observations really come in to their own, because you keep a keen observation of the tail lights coming on. The next thing is you're going to see that white light and probably a car reversing in front into your path. It's tough because it's so congested and there's so much movement from pedestrians and cars, but hopefully, you know, the Yoda approach, use the force, think ahead, anticipate, observe, it should come together to keep you safe.
All right, so let's talk about the general idea of looking down the road. I get the sense from the book that that people are, their attention span ahead of them is a little shorter than you think it should be.
It really is, and especially young drivers, they have very near focal points, so they obsess over small details that are close to them that are pretty irrelevant. As a result, they don't see things coming from a long way away. On a racetrack, you know, the likes of the Earnhardts and the Mario Andretti's out there, you have to look further ahead. When you're racing on a speedway, the speed is too fast to look at the things that are just at the end of your nose. You have to look like half a mile ahead of you to anticipate what's coming. So we learn that through that process, but it works just as well on the road. It works equally well. It's kind of like being a very small quarterback surrounded by really big guys that want to kill you. You learn what peripheral vision means and 360-degree observation because you're looking ahead. You don't want to get squashed. And again, that pays dividends on the highways.
And thank you for the reference to American football, too. There's a whole section here on the fuel benefits of smooth driving. So it's not just about not getting stuck behind trucks that are pulling up to unload and things like that, but it helps you with your fuel consumption. Tell us about that.
Well, that's it. So it's not always easy, this. And, you know, when you're in real traffic, sometimes you have no choice but to inch along and stop when the traffic stops. But for general driving, when you get out of town and there is some decent traffic flow, a lot of drivers will speed up and slow down and speed up and slow down endlessly for no reason and without thinking about what they're even doing. They wouldn't be aware of it until now. And every time you press the brake in that way and have to speed up again, you're wasting energy, you're wasting fuel. And so what's happened and what's very interesting is that insurance companies have analyzed this and they've used black boxes telemetry to measure how drivers operate the vehicle, and they found that the ones that stamp on each pedal all the time remorselessly not only burn more fuel, but they're more likely to crash because it means they're losing on anticipation.
Okay, more on how not to stamp on the pedals when we come back and talk more with Ben Collins about his book, How to Drive. You can join us as well back on the Jefferson Exchange with a steering wheel, a brake pedal, and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Ben Collins, a British race car and stunt driver who spent years as the Stig on the BBC show Top Knight, has also been in a Batman film, 3 James Bond films, you name it. He's probably done it with a car. And he shares his experience with us in a way that's constructive for us in today's driving situations. He's written a book called How to Drive, Real World Instruction and Advice from Hollywood's Top Driver. You can join us on the exchange with your stories of driving situations you wish you'd handled better or did handle well or wish you'd known more about. Let's hear your stories at 800-838-3760 over the phone. You can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. You were just talking about the speed up, slow down thing that a lot of drivers do. They're just sort of doing it unconsciously. I have noticed when I get in the car with somebody who drives in urban areas, like somebody from Los Angeles, when there's a lot of space ahead of them, they tend to speed up a lot because they're used to being close behind something else.
Yeah, it's one of those weird things. And in Florida, what happens is when they say never use the indicator to tell anyone you're leaving the highway. Otherwise, the guy on the inside speeds up to block you.
Right.
So there's this crazy sense of competition going on all the time. And it's one of those bad habits that people do without even thinking. And when you point it out to them, they say, oh, I don't do that. But of course they do. And racing from one traffic light to the next is completely futile when you have to stop when you get there. So that's exactly the kind of thing that burns fuel. And it kind of just puts stress on you and everyone around you for no real gain. So in those situations, it's just much easier to be cool and just creep up to it.
There's a lot in here about gear shifting, which prompts me to ask if you ever drive automatics.
I do a lot. I mean, even with racing now, it's rare to get a car where you have to shift around with the gears. You've got to either paddle shift, or in some cases, you know, with some of the stunt cars we're using, they're automatics. So I use all of them. I still think it's good to understand what is happening when you're using the gears in conjunction with the brakes, because the engine RPM, the engine braking that you get, is really crucial, especially in snow and ice conditions. It is much better to control the car with some of the engine braking resource that you have by being able to select the lower gear, even with an automatic, and to use that as a control system to reduce speed, because it's very easy on slippery conditions, ice and snow, if you use the brakes harsh, that you can create a skid. So that's one way you can use gears.
All right, but not suddenly is the point. I can attest to this myself, that you don't want to do a downshift in snow when you're already moving pretty fast.
True, that's exactly right. And with snow and ice, it pays to think ahead by a few weeks. Once you're on a frictionless surface, you're kind of in God's hand at that point. And what I would advocate is keeping an eye. You know, we were talking about weather earlier, and weather has become very unpredictable. But you can anticipate what's going on by, you can look at the thermometer on the dash of the car, tells you if you're in sub-zero. You know then to expect ice, and you start to feel and to listen. Even on black ice, one of the things you get is that the road noise suddenly stops. You've gone from being on the blacktop, tarmac, or asphalt or concrete to being on top of ice, and ice doesn't make any road noise when you're on it. So all these little tricks and ideas are things that can keep people safer at the wheel.
In dry conditions, you're just talking about engine braking. I want to talk about downshifting versus braking to slow and stop a car. I mean, the thing that really resonated with me was somebody saying, hey, your brakes are cheap, your engine and transmission are not.
It's a good point. They work in conjunction. The brakes are the key tool for slowing down. I would never advocate just using gears, except in things like the snow. And when it's really slippery, I try not to use the brakes. And to do that means, yeah, you have to look a lot further ahead and just get your foot out of the gas to let the engine run the speed off. What I don't mean is driving along, just crunch down into a short gear, because that's going to give you an expensive bill after a few years. So it's just being able to roll off the gas at the right time, and again, it just gives the car a lot more warning of what you're trying to do.
I haven't talked about steering, which is obviously the most basic maneuver in other than getting the car to go and stop. Is it 10 and 2 or 9 and 3? Have you decided where it goes now?
I'm a 9 to 3 guy. I would never have my hands anywhere else, but that's just me. I find that the T-bar, the place where the spokes meet the wheel, to me look perfectly formed. It's like a pistol grip. I find that my hands just want to be there. It's as if it was designed for it, which, of course, it was. Not all cars, the French being a good exception, they don't always build cars with spokes that meet the wheel at 9 to 3. But, 10 to 2, it works. I just find that you can turn more with your hands at 9 to 3. And, so I think you take your choice on that one.
Do practices like how you grip and use the wheel differ from country to country?
Yeah, in the UK, they doggedly insist that you shuffle the steering wheel instead of just turning through a smooth arc, which is one description. It was hand over hand or rotational steering.
Mm-hmm.
And I disagree with that model of teaching very much, because I think that it's very easy to get lost with how much steering you've put into the car. When the car does lose grip, generally speaking, it's at the front tires first. If you've taken your hands off the wheel and shuffled the thing around a few times, it's kind of like trying to work out which ball's underneath the cup when the magician's at work. And the car skids, the instinct is to turn the steering more. At that point, turning the steering more does not make the car turn. It makes it skid worse. Once the front tires have skidded, you run a little bit wide. The next thing that's going to happen is the back end goes and it will react all the worse for the excess steering that you've put in there. So you're just making the problem worse. The simple steering model, which actually most American drivers are taught, is to keep that 9 to 3 position. And that way, you know where your hands are on the wheel. You've got a better chance of controlling the skid with that steering model.
All right. On to braking. You mentioned not stomping it out like it's a fire. So what is the general approach you recommend to the brake pedal?
Well, if you do want to get into the sort of hardcore of braking, smooth everyday braking is what everybody in America is doing. We've talked about not doing it without good reason and how that burns fuel. If you want to stop quickly in a performance sense, you learn to dig into the pedal, not aggressively, but sharp enough that the weight transfers to the front tires quite quickly. And after that, you squeeze on the brake when the tires are loaded and ready to accept that braking force. But in an emergency, really, I might try and be cute with that, but really you want to get onto the pedal hard and fast as possible, because most, if not all, cars now are built with ABS, and that anti-skid system is designed to be engaged as quickly as possible. What it allows you to do is to stop very quickly whilst being able to steer around whatever it is you need to avoid in front of you, whether it's a child that stepped out in front or to avoid the accident ahead.
Ben, what do you think about anti-lock braking systems and what they do for or take away from drivers?
Well, it's taken away some responsibility. The thing that people misunderstand about it is they think that you can stop faster or shorter with ABS than you could before it, and that isn't the case. Actually, a skidding tire in the old days did kind of stop us shorter than with ABS, although the ABS is slowly creeping up and catching up with that. But what it did was we stopped having those little frights. So back in the 70s and 80s, you'd get a screeching tire, probably. That gave you some manners for the next month, if not year. We don't get that anymore. You're not really aware of when the tire is reaching the limit. And as a result, I think people fall into a false sense of security. So there was a study done that showed there were more fatal accidents after the introduction of ABS than before it, because people were going into curves faster than before and crashing out, rolling over, and meeting their maker that way. So, you know, we're not going to. The fact is, regardless of what I say, ABS is here to stay, and it's important that people understand how it does work, but also what the shortcomings are.
Yeah, you know, we come back again to tires here, which you've convinced me is the thing to really watch out for in the car, which is good because we just had to buy four new ones last week. What is it that happens to tires on curves? This is really interesting stuff.
Well, I don't know. I watch a lot of these physics programs. I always remember the golf ball in slow motion when it gets hit by a club. And you see this thing stretching in slow motion, which is it's invisible to the naked eye. But when you see it in slow motion, you realize how much elasticity is in that golf ball. And that's what really makes it fly. The same is true with the tire. They can stretch in all different directions at the same time, but they never stretch as well as they do in one direction only. And that's why you try to brake before the curve instead of braking in a panic in the middle of the curve when you suddenly see, you know, a patch of a puddle or something like that. So the tire is an organic thing. The better quality tires can cope more with combining forces of braking and turning through the curve and accelerating at the same time than some of these cheap imports. And the worst being, you know, things like retreads or second-hand tires with no idea of where that thing's come from, and it may not be suited to your car. You really put yourself in harm's way because the quality of the rubber and the way that the rubber molecules bite into the road surface, that's everything. That's the difference between having the grip and ending up in the ditch.
Mm-hmm. Here's a call from one of your countrymen, Tony and Talent. Welcome to the Exchange with Ben Collins, the author of How to Drive.
Hello. Yes, I never imagined the Stig could be so articulate.
I'm doing my best. I'm using a talking puppet.
I also wanted to know if you were the driver. Well, I suspect you're too young, really, to have been the driver of the Dejavu in the James Bond movie. I can't remember the name of it, but the Dejavu was my first car. And it's, I think it was a great invention, 602 cc's, 70 miles to the gallon even back then.
Wow. And designed to carry one bale of straw for the animals. it was a great car. Sadly, I didn't get to work on the Roger Moore films. That was way before my tenure, but it's a fun car. I've driven one badly. You get used to that umbrella handle gear change, and they're a lot of fun. They're lovely old cars, and actually, they're getting a huge resurgence in popularity, mostly as sort of coffee delivering machines these days. But, no, I've not done any stunts with that car, I'm afraid, but I loved watching those old Roger Moore films.
Yeah, Tony, thanks for sharing the memory with us. So I hesitate to ask this, given the number of cars you've driven, do you have a favorite production car?
I'm not sure. I've got lots, and I bound between them, but I do love a Ferrari. It's hard not to enjoy the mid-engine sports car, and one of my real favorites was the Ferrari 458, the Italia. The driver sits right in the center of the car. The weight is built around him and her. And again, it goes back. It's natural. It's organic. It's just like the car becomes part of you. You forget that it's there. You've just got this fantastic sound coming out of the exhaust. It's like an orchestra. So, I love that. And I did some very bad things with it on Top Gear and slid it sideways and burned those precious tires, but I loved every second.
How about electrics? You mentioned the Tesla earlier. What's the appeal you find in those? They do handle differently, you mentioned.
They do, and I was fortunate enough to be there in the very beginning of Tesla when they were first taking these kind of off-the-shelf cars and modifying them. And to be honest, it was like a science experiment at the beginning. But I was wishing them well all the way through, and you could see that the range was quite short. It was around sort of 80, 90 miles. It was only last year I got to drive the Model S, and I was just completely blown away by it. It was a phenomenal experience. And the best thing to liken it to is like being in a UFO. Everybody else is stuck with combustion engines, and we're talking about, you know, getting through traffic, and you see a gap you want to be in. With the Tesla, it has so much torque at any speed. You look at the gap, by the time you've thought about it, or the other guy thinks, hey, I want that gap, you're in it, you're there. Anyone with combustion just can't compete with it. It's the acceleration is great, and they've done a fantastic job to extend the battery range. It's something like 280 miles now, so it's a really, it's a practical solution, and it's great to see the way they've gone from A to B with that.
They really have. Let's finish up here talking about some of the common mistakes that drivers make that lead to accidents. What are some of the things that you really counsel people not to do?
Texting is probably the worst these days. You know, looking at stuff. Actually, the other one I didn't realize is, this is the fun of reading insurance reports for 3 years, but is reaching for the glove box snack. And I felt ashamed that I've been guilty of this sin for some time in the year. You know, I always keep a chocolate bar in the glove box just in case I feel a little drowsy or need to pull over and grab a coffee. But yes, that's a big cause of accidents. Who would have thought? But texting is a really obvious one. And you know, I hope that people will tune in to the fun of driving better, because actually once you're thinking about living in the moment, your ability to concentrate, stay alert, improves exponentially.
All right, and then we'll finish up with this one. When you see the sign saying your lane is closed 2 miles ahead, when should you change lanes?
As late as possible. Oh, no, I didn't say that. Yeah, I'm one of those. Again, it's an interesting one because I'm blaming a research document, and I should have the courtesy to at least quote the person that wrote it. But I agree with it straight away. I thought, why the queuing early? I think it's good to merge late, but do it nicely.
All right. It's a great set of suggestions. It's called How to Drive, Real World Instruction and Advice from Hollywood's Top Driver. That would be Ben Collins. Thanks so much for joining us today in The Exchange.
Thanks for having me. I had a great time. Take care.
Take care.